From the four corners of Southern California, this is The Hot Seat and Urinate with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. Today, as my in-booth guest, I have 33rd District Congressional Candidate Marianne Williamson. How are you, Ms. Williamson? Thank you very much for taking the time to join me today.
Well, I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And I would like to note that Ms. Williamson entered the race before Congressman Henry Waxman retired and is running as an independent. So, now without further ado, and because you have a busy schedule, let's get started. First, before I'd like to get into questions about the race, why are you here at USC today?
I'm here. I'm actually speaking at a class about women and spirituality and rebels and the role of women in spirituality and politics over the course of our history. Very excited about that.
And how do you have time to take away from your race to be able to be here today?
I think it's all part of the race. The students at USC and elsewhere, you know, your voters, this is part of a campaign, talking to people. That's what's exciting and creative and important.
Okay. And now I'd like to get into the campaign that you just talked about. And last week it got a little easier, and I like to think it got easier for a day when Henry Waxman announced his retirement before the field of Democrats started flying in. So before I get to the post-announcement time, I have to ask, before he actually retired, did you think you were going to win, or were you just doing your campaign? Were you running as a long shot candidate like Bill Bloomfield?
Well, first of all, Bill Bloomfield came within 8 points of Henry Waxman. So I don't think Bill Bloomfield was running as a long shot. I mean, this politics, you know, the pundits like to say that there's some formula and you can always know who's going to win a race. I entered the race with a serious intent, and that is to provide the District 33 voter with a genuine alternative to the politics of the political status quo. That message was what I carried with me 2 weeks before Congressman Waxman announced his retirement. It's what I carry now and will carry moving forward.
And how do you plan to do that, to deviate from the status quo and to bring everything you stand for into Washington?
Well, the political status quo, unfortunately, today is beholden to a very corrupt system. It's a legalized system of corruption in which money so dominates our functioning as a nation. The financial leverage, the money of moneyed forces, wields an influence on our politics so completely disproportionate to that of the average citizen, particularly since Citizens United, that until we address the underlying issue of getting money out of politics, then we will always be fighting for things that should be considered just the natural right of every American. We will not be able to deal adequately with climate change, child poverty, GMOs, the corruption of our food supply, our high mass incarceration rate, our military issues, none of this until we deal with this underlying cancer of getting money out of politics.
You talked about Citizens United, and I was going to say that's when a lot of this started with the super PACs. If you get elected to Congress, would you lead a movement to amend the Constitution to get rid of Citizens United?
Absolutely, and that effort already exists in Congress, and I absolutely would go there with everything I could possibly do to help magnify that message and move that process along.
Okay, and I'd now like to get back to the race for a moment. We have a field of candidates that has really yet to be determined. We know a few, but not all of them. How has your race changed since Henry Waxman announced his retirement?
Well, it's certainly the molecules, you know, there has certainly been a change. But no one can say in any way, is it better, is it worse? You know, once again, I'm in this for something more serious than the surface turbulence of the football game that politics is treated as today. It's treated like a game. It's a spectator sport. She's in, he's out. That's not what I'm doing this for. I'm doing this because I'm concerned about the future of American democracy. I'm concerned about the present of American democracy. I'm concerned about our shrinking civil liberties. I'm concerned about the NSA spying, about the drones that are coming, about the National Defense Authorization Act, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'm concerned about the lobbying. I'm concerned about the fact that the oil companies dominate our policy about climate and that the chemical companies and big ag dominate our policies about food. I'm concerned that the prison industrial complex dominates our policies about justice. So the conversation I'm having is not trendy. It's a deeper conversation, and I think that that's what the American people want. Politics should be a container for our deepest, most mature analysis and reflection as stewards of American democracy. And the current traditional political status quo is a container for the most shallow conversation. I'm not inhabiting that space, and I think millions of Americans would like to inhabit another one as well.
That being said, you are new at the political game, and for all intents and purposes, elections are essentially like games. How should voters Why should voters trust you that you'll be able to go there and being green, be able to make the difference and influence it and change things that you want to change?
I'm not enrolled in your construct here, because when you said I'm green at the game, that's kind of the point. I'm not playing that game. That game is what's so corrupt. When you send someone to Congress, and by the way, whoever we send now, because Henry Waxman has announced his retirement, whoever we send is now a first-term congressperson. The other people who have announced so far, as in Wendy Gruhl, the two front-running Democrats, Wendy Gruhl and Tim Lu, That's exactly what they are. They are career politicians. I'm sure they're lovely people, but their work and their ability and their skill set and their attitudes perpetuate politics as it is now. I think that's the point. I think that my conversation and the policies that I propose actually constitute a pattern interruption. And that's what's so good. You know, politics, the root of the word politics, does not mean of the government. It means of the people. That's what's wrong with America today, is that politics has become a game. It's that politics has become a completely separate category of our experience. That's why so many people are turned off by it. And I also think this is why so many people are excited about my campaign. How many people say, I'm interested in politics for the first time ever or in a long time? Because people don't feel that the conversation matches where they live inside their hearts and minds.
I understand it's not a political game, but most people and the way our political structure is right now, it is constructed like a game. And I admire that you want to do something different. And I think being in Congress, that's completely different than running. But running essentially is like a game because it's all about trying to beat the other person and trying to raise enough money.
You know, I kind of disagree with that. First of all, I've raised almost $360,000. That's certainly more than any other candidate in the race has done. I've been in business. I'm an entrepreneur for a long time. I know that in order to be in business, in order to succeed at it, you have to raise money, and I'm raising money. But the way that in politics they talk about money, money, money all the time as though that's everything, I would say people energy is every bit as important. You know, I remind you that in the last race, Bill Bloomfield outspent Henry Waxman 7-1, and mm-hmm. he did not win. So it is not just about money. And I think that there are many people who are absolutely turned off by the fact that it is treated that way. You know, you talk about our system. Well, there's our system, and then there's this overlay of the traditional politics. Our system has to do with the U.S. Constitution. Our system is that the people of District 33 get to vote on who they want to go to Congress to represent their views and to vote on their behalf. That is the system. All of this other stuff is this game, and the game is the problem. And to say that I'm not playing that game does not mean that I don't have a campaign or that I'm not raising money or that I'm not doing all the things you have to do. But to be sucked into that and to just be part of that is, first of all, not the way for me to win. And second of all, it's not the way for me to do what I came here to do. We need to reorient ourselves in terms of our own personal relationship to politics. And that's what millions of Americans are ready to do. The fact that the traditional elite, you know, political elite and status quo is having a different conversation doesn't mean that we have to.
I understand. And I want to move back and talk about you said you're an entrepreneur. You're also involved. You're also a spiritual leader. How do you believe those qualities and your background will make you good at being an elected official?
You know, I have worked up close and personal for 30 years with people whose lives are in crisis. And my skill set has to do with turning crisis into opportunity. And a nation, all that a nation is a collection of individuals. And the United States is in crisis in many areas, and we are not doing the work necessary to turn that crisis into into rebirth and renewal and opportunity. In order to do that, we need to do more than just fix a few things on the external basis here and there. We need to have a deep inquiry about what's going on. What's going on in our democracy? I don't think our democracy is doing well. We have a crisis of our democracy. You know, when you have 1% of your population controlling 38-40% of your wealth, and you have 60% of your population living on 2.3% of your wealth, that disparity alone represents a crisis of democracy. Louis Brandeis said, the late Supreme Court justice, you can either have large amounts of money concentrated in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy. You cannot have both. And what we have today is a kind of citizen lockout. The average citizen is locked out of the level of political influence we should all have. The average citizen in America is locked out of the kind of educational opportunity we should all have. And the average citizen is locked out of the kind of economic opportunity we should all have. We are existing now as a kind of aristocracy. Some people call it a corporatocracy or a plutocracy. It doesn't matter what words we use. But the point is that we repudiated an aristocratic system in 1776, and it is time to repudiate it again.
And I wasn't going to talk about policy, but now I feel the absolute need to. How do you plan to change all of this? What are your specific ideas and what are your plans of action?
The most important thing has to do with getting money out of politics, because once again, this is the root of the problem. You know, just 2 days ago, Nancy Pelosi introduced a bill, I think it's called For the People, that would have to do with getting at this problem. There are a lot of arrows in the quiver. And as you yourself mentioned, this goes all the way up to and including the idea for a constitutional amendment that would outlaw the undue influence of money and probably dictate that corporations do not have the right of personhood.
How do you plan to do that, though? Because I know that Congress people are very hesitant to change laws and rules that benefit themselves, such as lobbying. And I'm sure that there'd be a resistance by some against this amendment because they're able to get super PAC, I guess, not funding, but super PAC ads either for or blasting the other candidate. So what is your specific plan to pitch this idea, and how do you plan to get politicians in the local and state areas or jurisdictions to get behind this?
Well, first of all, the job is not necessarily to get the local and state officials behind it. It has to do with what you're doing in Washington. This is why what you're saying points out why we need more independent voices. The parties are beholden to this money, the corporate money. They're beholden to it. And many politicians, in order to get in office and stay in office, need to depend on that money. Mine is a grassroots campaign. My average donation is $51. And that's important because, as you yourself pointed out, I have a job. I have a nice career. I don't need to do – my need is to speak my truth. That's my internal compelling need. And more people – that's why it's important to support candidacies like mine. And I think that my winning this race will help create a space for more people around the country, not just as independents. You know, I've been a Democrat all my life. I think of myself as a kind of independent Democrat. But we need people who are not just within the box of the party structure, both within the parties and outside, talking about this need from a place of, and if I don't get the corporate money, I can still be elected by the people of the district or not. But we need to have this conversation. We need to have this movement. This needs to be a national movement.
How do you plan to start that specifically, though?
I'm doing it right now. I'm doing it by talking to you. You know, I've lived in California. This city gave me my career. And I've written 10 books, six New York Times bestsellers, four number ones. The conversation that I began having in Los Angeles in 1983, if I may say so, is now a major mainstream cultural impulse. So I know how a conversation can change things. I've been there. I've seen it in my own career. So this is not just pie in the sky for me. You start talking to people, you have a different message. It's the one that people inside their minds and hearts are talking about. And this area of the country, this area of the world, we start things here. We start a new conversation in this city. It's a national trend within 5 years. A lot of people, a lot of voters are hearing that and investing themselves in this campaign for that reason. It is time for something new.
You talk about something new, but Henry Waxman was a member, or currently is the ranking member on Energy and Commerce, and was the former chair of the Oversight Committee. Do you plan, if you're elected, do you plan to continue that legacy of the 33rd District of being on Energy and Commerce, or would you and try to continue his work on certain subjects, or do you want to start completely anew?
Well, of course, no first-term congressperson is going to be given a
well, I know
ranking
not the ranking member,
yes,
but on
course.
The committee, though.
Of course. I would like – I feel that certainly my views on the environment are the same. I mean, he is a legendary figure. He is a historic figure in his work on the environment, and I absolutely feel very strongly that the debate should be deemed over. Climate change is a clear and present danger, not only for our country, but to the future of the human race. In fact, one of the areas where I feel that my candidacy goes a little further is that I feel that we should not be using nuclear energy for domestic purposes whatsoever. So absolutely, I'm aligned in my thinking with that of Congressman Waxman. I feel that my greatest skills could be used in the area of children and education. That's where I think that I could be of the most value.
And you talk about education. How do you mean? Because education, there's been this debate since essentially No Child Left Behind about whether it's more of a state issue or a federal government issue. What do you want to do on the national level about education? What are your thoughts on the government influence on states' rights for education?
I think the issue of preschool is the most important one of all. We now know, in a way the founders did not know, in a way that people didn't know 70 years ago, the importance of early childhood. And the most important factor in eradicating poverty is universal preschool. I don't think it should be mandatory, because some parents really don't want to send their kids to school before the age of 5, but I think it should be universally available. What happens in this country today is that people who cannot afford it tend not to send their children to preschool, and then that child starts day one of kindergarten already behind. This is very critical, because if we do not catch that baby up within 2 years, by the time they get into the second grade, if they cannot read yet, they are already on a 50% probability trajectory to incarceration. And if we have not caught them up by the fourth grade, you can actually look at how many American children cannot read in the fourth grade and how many prison beds will then be built. So for me, it has to do with preschool, and it also has to do with college. The fact that the average loan that is carried by the American student is $30,000. What we are doing is that we are making education itself. This is exactly what I was talking about before, about the citizen lockout. We are in the pattern of making education itself the purview of those who can afford it. That is not America. That is not democracy. I see every child in America as a potential genius. And if we do what we can, you know, the traditional politician talks about kids getting out of college and having a job waiting for them. I don't see it that way. I see every American baby as someone who, if we educate properly over the next 12 years, will come out of college and they'll be able to create their own $6 million company if they want to. They will be the job creators. So if we have universal preschool and find a way, which we could do, Oregon is dealing with some free college programs. I think a year of national service. Let a young person in America have a year of national service and be able to get educated. I think that would be great for everybody. If you want to stimulate your economy, put more people, allow more people to go into the economy who know, have the skills and have the access to what is necessary for them to create companies and to be entrepreneurs and to do great things.
And you talk about, I want to talk about some of the points of your answer, but specifically, you talk about universal preschool. Being in the House, you have the advantage of having the Constitution in your favor in terms of starting budget-raising bills or cash-raising bills through the Ways and Means Committee. What do you plan to do how do you plan to raise enough revenue to be able to make the preschool universally available?
Well, first of all, it's not just about raising revenue. It's also about recognizing what we spend our money on. I mean, as long as you're having tax cuts to billionaires, as long as you are subsidizing corporations to the tune of billions of dollars that are already bringing in profits of a trillion, this is where the rot is. This is where the corruption is. The very fact that Americans think, well, where are we going to get the money? Which they never ask when they want to wage another war. Have you noticed? This is not about raising revenue. This is about the values that are demonstrated by the money that we budget now.
So instead of implementing new taxes, you want to be able to cut down the corporate tax loopholes?
Yes, and I don't see why billionaires are getting their taxes cut.
Okay. And again, because I plan on interviewing you later, as well as some of the other candidates, I'm not going to refrain from giving my personal opinion on some of these answers. But I want to talk about what you were talking about earlier, or just a moment ago, which was Eric Garcetti's making a push to get 10,000 jobs created in Los Angeles, and L.A. was designated as one of the first 5 promise zones, or parts of L.A. were, and Sean Donovan, who's the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, as well as Arne Duncan, who's the Secretary of Education, both share have a similar view that you do. So how will you work with them, work with the local municipalities within your district, and work with other federal agencies to make all of that happen?
Well, I think that when you become a congressperson, you have the power that you have and you don't have the power that you don't have. I mean, a first-term congressperson, any congressperson, nobody has a magic wand here. I'm not naive about that. And And I don't think the voters are naive about that. I will be one of 435 congresspeople, and I will have the power that is given me, mainly the power to have new ideas, new conversations, and the power of the vote. Of course, in representing my district, I will be working to the best of my ability with people on a state and local level, as well as a federal level, to stand on the values that I think are important. And I think when you mentioned what you did about the Promise Zones, about Arne Duncan and others, they share, absolutely. And Mayor Garcetti, they share the values that I hold about what this country needs, and I will work in any way possible to increase on a federal level through my office the kinds of activities that would be most helpful.
Okay, and I'm going along the same lines, but switching the topic to climate change, what do you plan to do to specifically reduce the United States' carbon footprint on the earth?
Well, let's look at something like the Keystone Pipeline. We now have a government report that's come out basically giving the president a pass so that he can approve this thing if he wishes. This is just an act of theater, and it is unconscionable. So what I will do is use my voice. What I will do, you know, I have a national following as an author. And a lot of what is necessary now is for the American people to wake up. I think the biggest problem we have is the disengagement of the average American. I think if the American people really wake up, you talk about a major carbon footprint issue, look at the Keystone Pipeline. Now, on the level of voting, I'm just one of 435. On the level of using my voice, I feel that for the last 30 years I've proven that I say what I think, and I will do everything possible not only in Congress but also outside of Congress with the platform that being a congressperson affords me to help awaken the American people to the trajectory that is being played out here by something like the president's approval of the Keystone Pipeline.
You say you're one of 435, and there are about 200, more than 200 people in Congress who deny climate change every time it's mentioned. What do you plan to do to bring the other party, the Republicans I'm talking about, and get them to understand what you're talking about and get them to try to understand climate change and believe it actually exists?
You know, that's everybody, every district of the United States gets to send their representative to Congress. It's not my job to, quote unquote, get anyone to do anything. What I can do is to express to the best of my ability my beliefs, and to do so with honor and to do so with respect. I'm not responsible for where other people go inside their minds and their hearts, but I can seek to speak with a kind of courtesy and respect that would make it more probable that they would be able to hear what I have to say.
Okay, let me rephrase the question then, because you say you're one of 435 votes. What are you going to do to try to get more votes than just the Democrats in Congress to get behind, to work with you on climate change?
Actually, my answer remains the same. I will speak with conviction, but I will speak with courtesy, and I will speak with honor. I will try to build human relationships, because I know, as someone who has been I've been an author, I've been a lecturer, I've been an entrepreneur for 30 years. I know that relationships are everything, and that's where it all begins. That people can hear you and that people are open to hear what you have to say. I do believe that there are some good people in Congress. And even when you talk about climate change deniers, how do you think they got there? They got there because they were sent there by the moneyed interests that are exactly what I'm talking about. And that's why, until we deal with that underlying issue, none of this will really change.
Okay. And I want to stay on the lines of partisanship. What are you going to do as you call yourself an independent Democrat? What are you going to do to use that status to try to bridge the divide between the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress to reduce the polarization that we see at the present time?
It doesn't work that way. You don't walk in and this, you know, sometimes the state of your being is as important as your state of your doing. I can't walk into a room and, quote unquote, make somebody change their mind. All I can do is speak mine, once again, with honesty, with courtesy, and with respect, and try to build human relationships. That's where it all begins.
Okay. And staying along these similar lines, being an independent Democrat, would you caucus with the Democrats?
Absolutely. I would caucus with the Democrats. I've been a Democrat all my life. And in the primary system that we have in California, I put decline to state because I feel that it's very important that there be a people's movement in the United States. Abolition did not come from a major party. Women's suffrage did not come from a major party. Civil rights movement did not come from a major party. And I feel we need independent voices. But I never intended that, to create the impression that I'm not connected. I mean, I'm a Bobby Kennedy Democrat. I'm a Paul Wellstone Democrat. I am a Eugene McCarthy Democrat. And that is where I've been throughout my life. I simply think that the chokehold that the two parties are having on the conversation today is sucking some oxygen out of our public discourse.
Okay. And I want to talk about two policy points moving on, and one of which is the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, and how do you plan to continue its implementation across this union?
Well, when Max Baucus, Senator Max Baucus, would not allow single payer to even be discussed in his committee, I knew we had a problem. We need to talk, you know, the Affordable Care Act is like a symptom. It's not the disease. It's like an effect. It's not the cause. So I think we need to, in order to deconstruct what's happened here, we need to go back to the beginning. President Obama got as much money from the health insurance companies as John McCain did. This is where the real problem is. The problem is that the health insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies dictated what they wanted first. And that's what happens in American politics today. The multinational corporations, acting as a kind of aristocracy, say what they want, and then the politicians try to get us, you know, I'll get you the bigger pile of crumbs. No, I'll get you the bigger pile of crumbs. So we should have been talking about universal health care from the beginning, like every other Western industrialized nation. We should have been talking certainly of the possibility of single payer from the beginning, extension, expansion of Medicare, and so forth. We didn't. It was this compromise with principle, and so it's a mess. Is it better than nothing? Absolutely, because you have the pre-existing condition issue removed. You have more people who are able to get insurance, but it's a mess. And I think, and what I would stand on is universal, universal, universal.
Okay. And the other policy point I want to talk about is transportation. Now, Los Angeles is a city of gridlock, and there are a lot of cars on the road. What do you plan to do to try to fix our public transit system and improve the gridlock we have here, whether it be via public transit or via highway projects?
Well, your U.S. congressperson doesn't come in and, quote unquote, fix the transportation problem in Los Angeles. This has to do with Eric Garcetti and has to do with local and state officials throughout the region. What I would do is seek to work with them and seek, wherever possible, to gain the kind of federal resources that would help in the process. But it's not your U.S. congressperson's job to, quote unquote, fix the transportation in Los Angeles.
You're right. I used the wrong word. It shouldn't have been fixed. It should have been advocate for.
Advocate for. Certainly, I would work with the mayor and all other interested parties and seek to provide federal resources where appropriate.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the Hot Seat today, Candidate Williamson. It was a pleasure having you on. The Hot Seat After Hours starts right now. You can email the Hot Seat inbox at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can also read and follow my blog at maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. You can subscribe to the Hot Seat's newsletter by clicking on the link on our page on annenbergradio.org/podcast. Go to the Hot Seat, and it is the link under our description. Thank you for listening. I hope you all will join me next time with Assemblyman Stephen Bradford.